And now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
It turns the brains into guacamole.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back. This is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain here on KKZZ, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura and Santa Barbara Counties. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is jobs, politics, the war on terror, and new enlightenment. Each of today's segments is exploring one or more of these subjects. My next guest started his career in music and transitioned to create a think tank focusing on a philosophical exploration of well-being and the quality of life. We'll discuss his latest book, Ego, The Fall of the Twin Towers and the Rise of an Enlightened Humanity. And if you want to join in the conversation or if you want to ask a question, you can call us at 639-0008. Peter Baumann began his career as a member of the internationally acclaimed 1970s band Tangerine Dream. They went on to garner several gold records. And later, he founded the private music label, which he sold to RCA a few years after that. Instead of being derailed by early fame and fortune, Peter asked himself this in his late 40s. Given that I'll probably have about 10,000 days left on this planet, how should I use my time in the most meaningful and useful way possible? To address this question, Baumann assembled a top-notch interdisciplinary think tank, the San Francisco-based Baumann Foundation. He serves as a trustee of the California Institute of Integral Studies, as well as a fellow at Mind and Life Institute. Peter's been happily married for 27 years, is a father to three grown children, and resides in the San Francisco Bay Area, joining us from the Bay Area. Hi, Peter. How are you today?
Hi, Billy. How are you? Very well here.
Oh, good. I'm happy to hear that. Thank you for being our guest here today on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. And your book is really the first book that I've read of its kind to look at original and the evolution, the origin and the evolution of the human ego. Why did you choose to write about the ego through the lens of the tragedy of 9/11?
Well, we could have used quite a few different lenses, but 9/11 obviously was such a landmark event that it delivered a lot of angles that we could use to explain the evolutionary angle on why an ego evolved. We could have just as easily used the Nazis, or we could have used the Khmer Rouge, or we could have used the Crusaders, all of which have one thing in common, that is that they were fighting and fighting ideas. So that is the commonality, but 9/11 was the most relevant event that we could find that would explain this.
All right. Well, so connect the dots for us, Peter. How did the tragedy of 9/11, which, by the way, we're coming up on the 10-year anniversary, how did that put humankind on the path to further enlightenment?
Well, I wouldn't say that particular event did that. You want to take a larger perspective on why something like 9/11 happened, and again, many other events similar to it, and understand how human beings can develop mental attitudes that lead them to kill for ideas rather for their mere survival. And that's the angle. So again, it's not about 9/11 other than it was a very clear example how identification with belief systems can really wreak havoc.
All right. So, again, help us to connect some of the dots. We started out as foragers on the plains of Africa at some point, and what separates us from, say, the rest of the ape family is that we have this unique thing called an ego. So what is it that makes the ego unique? Have human beings always possessed an ego? Is that what separates us from the rest of the animals in the animal kingdom?
Well, actually, I would propose human beings did not possess an ego. It was about 50,000 years ago when the first signs emerged, and they emerged in the capacity of conceptualization. And we can see that in terms of paint drawings, and the first complex tools arose, and those can only be achieved with the capacity of conceptualization, which means you have some kind of idea of an end product in mind. And that was a removal from our orientation in our physical environment. The hunter-gatherers were very concerned about predators and prey in their immediate environment. And when conceptualization became a capacity in the human mind, we started to think about the future beyond our immediate environment. And that was a very, very successful evolutionary adaptation. All of civilization depended on that capacity.
Well, in fact, you call it the conceptual revolution about 50,000 years ago. Now, my listeners know about the agricultural revolution, the industrial revolution, and, of course, now the information revolution. But you say that the conceptual revolution is really what kicked off all the rest of these things, and it was a defining moment in human history. What were some other examples of the conceptual revolution that we can look back on and say, aha?
Well, basically, all of civilization depended on the conceptual revolution, and you're correct that all the other revolutions were byproducts of the conceptual revolution, when human beings had the capacity to contemplate their own existence and contemplate the future. And we began really protecting our immediate environment, and that was expanded through our capacity of conceptualization to defending our ideas and expanding our sphere of influence. And the ego is really a byproduct of that process.
All right, now, Peter, go on. I didn't mean to cut you off there, Peter.
Yeah. So the ego is really a mental representation of us as a living organism. And that was useful in order to project us into a different environment. So if I have a mental representation of my own body, then I can project it somewhere into the future. And that was extremely useful to predict whether any outcome would be positive or negative for me. Like if I say I wander across the desert without any water, that might not be a good idea.
Right.
I could project that into the future. And that was so successful that identification with this mental representation became really who we think we are.
All right. So the ego, then, as you describe it, really is part of our survival mechanism. When did it become so deeply ingrained in our brain that it really became part of our whole survival mentality?
Well, it was a gradual process of since 50,000 years ago. But I would say the peak of what I would call the dissociation from the body was the Victorian age, where nothing below the neck really existed. I mean, we were all in the head. It was all about status. It was all about conquering and dominating. And since then, there have been the first signs that that is loosening up, and we're starting to recognize that we actually have bodies and that other people matter, and we're actually connecting to other people since the Victorian age. I mean, that's when slavery started to be abolished. That's when women got their right. That's when we stopped burning women at the stake. And that's what I propose is going to happen in the future.
The
process of embodiment is going to continue, and that we're going to recognize the falsity of the ego, which for most people is like feels like a substantial entity, but really is only a mental representation.
All right, I'm going to hit the pause button here, Peter, for just a second and take you back, because you say the Victorian age was sort of the embodiment of your ideal, and I can see what you're saying there, but I'm going to go back to the Crusades, the 1200s, and look at the Crusades, because there is a great example, perhaps the biggest worldwide example, of people fighting for ideas, this whole idea of our ego and projecting it outward. So talk to me about the Crusades. Talk to me about how that really was a reflection of our ego and trying to manifest our ego on Islam in this particular case.
Well, again, it's the identification with the belief system. The ego is a very complex representation in the brain, and it really is a representation of our body, but also of our skills. It's also our autobiography, and it's also our belief system. So you believe you're a Republican or you believe you're a Democrat, and whatever you believe, the other, which is not the same as you, is your enemy.
Well, we certainly see that in American politics today, don't
exactly.
we?
Exactly.
Go on with that thought, though, because can the two sides ever be reconciled? And let's just use American politics as the example. Can we come together as a country and really find a common goal that we can move forward towards?
Well, I believe that, evolution is a very messy business, and it really doesn't care about you and me, Billy, I hate to tell you. But it is a process that is much, much larger than the individual. And when evolution runs into a wall, so to say, when it doesn't move forward anymore because there is such a controversy, then it breaks down, there is a crisis, and out of that crisis, a new structure emerges.
And that's what we're going through right now. My guest is Peter Bauman, author of the new book, Ego, The Fall of the Twin Towers and the Rise of an Enlightened Humanity. And Peter, your investigation into the ego has really revealed some unexpected revelations about this. And let's talk about some of those revelations. I mean, you state that emotions are mostly physical, not mental. How does that happen?
Well, I mean, they're really generated inside the body, and when you're in a threatening situation, you can actually, how your body prepares for flight or fight, and that's a physiological process that is also an evolutionary adaptation.
All right, but let's use the example of a snake coiled up in the middle of a road. It's your mental perception of that that causes the physical reaction, not the other way around, isn't it, Peter?
No, it's not. It's actually a subconscious recognition. We have like certain presets that are hardwired. For instance, if something moves that's big and large, then we shrug back, we take notice. If something's thrown at us, we'll duck. Those are hardwired reflexes that were built in by evolution to avoid threats.
Well, now, I've got grandchildren, and when my grandchildren were really babies, before they had any preconceived idea, well before they were walking, you could actually take a spongy ball and throw it to them, and they wouldn't flinch. They wouldn't move. It would just hit them and bounce off. And then eventually they learned, ooh, I don't want to be hit by the ball, or hitting the ball is a bad thing. So is it truly built in deeply into our brain as innate, as an instinct, or is it something that we learn over time, like my grandchildren learned about the ball coming at them?
Well, it is actually both. It is built in, but the brain in a very young child is not fully developed to have perfect motor coordination. I mean, they can't ride a bike when they're 1.5 years old.
Right.
So the brain needs to wire itself to express these reflexes.
All right. Well, that's a great answer. My guest is Peter Bauman. All right. The other thing, Peter, that I found very interesting in your revelations is that evolution has wired us to rivet ourselves to bad news, bad outcomes, and worst-case scenarios. So we're sort of predisposed to being negative, I guess, in your example. Talk to me about that, because there's also a case to say that we as human beings are innately optimistic, and that's what keeps us moving forward. How do we balance those two things?
Well, fundamentally, we have to have a positive bias towards life. We have to fundamentally feel that living is better than not living. Otherwise, who would go through this whole mess? So we have a positive bias fundamentally, but we have a much larger antenna for something that potentially could harm us than could benefit us. And the equation is very simple this. It's called a negativity bias, because if you oversee something that potentially can threaten you, it might be the last time. But if you oversee something that's potentially positive, you still live to see another day.
All right, so how do our leaders and our politicians and really anybody in a position of authority use that negativity bias that you talk about to motivate us, to galvanize our ideas to move forward for a concept or an ideal?
Well, actually, they're abusing it, you know, and sometimes I believe actually quite deliberately, you know, by always screaming the world is coming to an end, and if the other guy is going to be elected, that's going to be the end of America as we know it, and so on and so forth. These are all mechanisms to reach people and get people's attention and say, hey, here's a big threat. And people respond to big threats better than to opportunities.
Well, that they do. And I guess that sort of leads me into one of your other remarkable findings in the book, is when our beliefs are challenged, it actually triggers a sort of a life or death stance that in our human nervous system. Talk to me about the findings there.
Well, fundamentally, the nervous system is only wired in two ways. Either it's a threat or it's an opportunity. Now, that's physiologically built in. And then with the conceptual revolution, what happened that we were able to conceptualize potential scenarios, but we use the body, the physiology, to evaluate those. So it's still a current moment evaluation of a potential future threat. So if somebody talks about ideas, it is physiologically is if they attack you in the present moment.
Wow, that's incredible. My guest is Peter Bauman. We're talking about his latest book, Ego, The Fall of the Twin Towers, The Rise of an Enlightened Humanity. So, Peter, we've talked about some of the findings and everything else, but in your book you say that the age of ego might be coming to an end, that the evolutionary process may be moving the human species towards a watershed transition. What is that watershed transition that you talk about?
Well, this is probably something that's going to happen over several generations. And the most significant thing about human beings is that we are able to produce surplus. I mean, the current economic situation taken aside, but in general, over our history, we've always been able to produce more than we consumed. And when basic needs are met for all of our citizens and then all of humanity, then the threat level diminishes. And we are not going to be scared like there's nothing to eat anymore or, you know, somebody's going to take away what you have. And as that process continues, when there is a surplus for everybody that lives on this planet, then the triggers for belief systems are going to be far less effective.
All right, but let's talk about that, because even today, right now, as we speak, we have the capacity to produce enough food to feed the entire planet. Yet we've got China, who buys all of our surplus grain, our wheat, our corn, and they use it in their consumption. As their economic status gets better and better, they want a higher standard of living and better foods to eat. And yet in Africa, you look at sub-Saharan Africa, there's more poverty, more starvation there than just about any place else on the globe. So yes, we have the capacity to produce this surplus, as you say, Peter, but how it's distributed still remains very fragmented and very spotty.
That's correct. And this is a matter of technology. As we have developed better technology, we have been able to feed more and more individuals. And if you look at the statistics from the UN, there is actually less famine in the world than there was 10 years or 20 years ago. So we're moving in the right direction. And I'm just proposing that this is a long, drawn-out process.
Okay, and it definitely will be a multi-generational process. But talk to me then about, as the fear level goes down, because we don't want anything anymore, Peter, how does that alter our behavior? What is the next evolutionary step going to look like?
Well, of course, Billy, this is all a matter of speculation.
Of course, but still.
But, you know, I would propose that when you really truly get what you need to survive, then you suddenly receive much more pleasure out of the people around you to do well. And we see that in many occasions. You know, I mean, charity altruism is not a new invention. But I believe that as we go down the road, that altruism and compassion will actually spread in farther and farther circles.
All right. And will this mean the demise of the capitalist versus socialist systems that we see governments using to control their people?
Well, you know, from a very large perspective, I would propose that both systems end up in the same space, and that is that capitalism wants the most people to have the most benefit, and so eventually does communism. You know, that it's a different mechanism. Where do you put the resources? And communism says the resources should be equally spread, and capitalism says, no, we want to put the resources in the most productive people. And as I look at it today, capitalism has the better strategy.
Well, so far it certainly has won out. You just have to take a look at the former Soviet Union to figure
exactly
that part out. My guest is Peter Baumann. He's the author of the book Ego, The Fall of the Twin Towers and the Rise of an Enlightened Humanity. Peter, what do you want people to take away from reading your book, Ego?
Well, I want them to take away that all their experiences are a matter of dividing the world between pleasant and unpleasant. And there is no escape. It doesn't matter what you gain in your life, whether you have status, a lot of goods, or you become a very famous person, it's always going to be pleasant and unpleasant to one degree or another. The only freedom you're going to have is to see that, to gain a larger perspective on what it means to be a human being, and not to get caught up in the rat race of trying to feel good all the time, trying to be happy all the time. But see these up and downs, this roller coaster of life, as just a natural, evolved way that human beings orient themselves in their environment.
Ah, that's a very good way of looking at things, a very simplified view by Peter Baumann, author of the book Ego, The Fall of the Twin Towers, The Rise of an Enlightened Humanity. Peter, if people want to learn more about you, learn more about the book, maybe even learn more about your foundation, where would you direct them to go on the Internet?
Well, for the book, we have a website called egothebook.com. And we post updates, you know, on a daily basis that are relevant to the subject. And the BaumannFoundation.org is the foundation that supports this work.
That is great. My guest has been Peter Baumann, author of the book Ego. Peter, it has been a delight. Thank you so much for being my special guest here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We'll talk to you down the road.
Well, thank you, Billy, for having me.
Thank you.